Noura Erekat is a 21-year-old Palestinian-American student at the University of California at Berkeley. Born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, Erekat traveled to Palestine 3 times as a teenager. But last year, the University of California, citing concern for her safety, denied Erekat's request for placement in a Palestinian university for a study abroad program. She ended up instead at Hebrew University in Israel, and 2 months later, the Intifada broke out. In this interview for Wings, Erekat speaks of her experiences in the Middle East, beginning with her first visit to Palestine at age 14.
It was almost as if I'd been there before. I wanted to actually move there. As an Arab American growing up in the States, it's that constant tug and pull. And I found a place for myself, but my family couldn't reconcile that hyphenated identity. And so for me to ease the pain, I really, really, really wanted to live in Palestine, to do my high school education there. They disagreed, but at age 14, they let me travel there by myself. And that was the first time. And I spent my summer basically with family and meeting cousins I never knew and really just learning what it was to live in Palestine, to live as a Palestinian among Arabs and a culture that I knew only in my home in the States, but I never knew outside of my home. By the time that I decided to go again to study abroad, I was completely ready and only to find different reality than I had expected.
When did you go back to study?
I was 20, and it was the beginning of my junior year in college. I left in June of 2000. Because I had wanted to do some programs in Palestine, working on taking American delegations throughout the region, the occupied territories, and Israel proper, sort of as a fact-finding delegation and educational tour. So I went there starting from June, and I didn't start classes at Hebrew University till August 8th, 2000.
And what did your parents or your grandparents tell you about Palestine when you were growing up? Was this a place where they had hoped to return to?
You know what? My parents are interesting. They immigrated to the States in 1975, and they immigrated completely with that mentality of, we're going to make it. We can achieve the American dream if we try hard enough. So for them, the goal wasn't to get me to return or to get us to return. Our goal was to make it because that opportunity isn't available in Palestine. So where it is available, we have to go for it. So as I was growing up, they really, as much as possible, tried to depoliticize our atmosphere. But when the Gulf War hit, I was 10 years old, and at home, things sort of took a turn. My mom was afraid that they're going to put us in camps like they put the Japanese in World War II. They're really afraid. For some reason, we're a threat to them. You have to be careful. In classes, when I would say things like, you know what, I don't think this war is about protecting America. I think it's about something to do with oil. Because that's what I was hearing at home. And kids in class were just like, what? How can you say that about our country? And so at that point, my extended family, my grandparents from my mom's side, who had lived in Kuwait at the time as Palestinian refugees in Kuwait, that's when they immigrated to the U.S. And suddenly I see this family that I knew lived in Kuwait, but for some reason they're in the United States. And for them, it wasn't an issue about going back. They were kicked out of Palestine. They've been kicked out of Kuwait, out of the entire Middle East. Now it's time to start something, to live. That was the hope that they have. So growing up, I didn't really have the emphasis of you need to work on going back to Palestine at all.
So you went to Palestine at the age of 14, and you spent a summer there, and then you came back at 20, and how had things changed?
Well, I also went back at 16 and 18. At 16, when I went, it was still that same very romantic idea I had at Palestine, because at 16, when I went with all my Arab American cousins, those who were also born in the States, and so we all decided that it would be a summer that we would spend together in Palestine. So it was still that very romantic vision. At 18, I went in the winter of 1998 to volunteer at 3 refugee camps, Dehesha in Bethlehem, Abed Jabir in Jericho, and Ain Sultan in Jericho. And I think that was the hardest experience. That was when I saw the face of Palestine, not through American eyes or tourist eyes, but actually as the Palestinians live. That was the first time I realized there were internal refugees, and it was the most excruciating. It was incredibly painful because within mainstream Palestine, even socioeconomically, people are so stratified that it's not on everyone's agenda to return. people's agenda is filled with how to survive. So I did it alone. And that's, I think, why it was so difficult to be in refugee camps and to be working on an issue that the rest of Palestinian society, it, literally, the right of return is part of a long list. When I went at 20, I had expected to come back to that harshness. And instead, what I was surprised to find this time was the American commercialization of Areas A, which were under full Palestinian autonomy because the West Bank and the Gaza Strip were split up, the occupied territories were split up into three areas. Areas A under civilian and military Palestinian control, Areas B under Palestinian civilian but Israeli military control, and Areas C under both Israeli civilian and military control. So in the Areas A, I found what they had become was almost like these free trade zones for foreign corporations to come in, the Marlboro billboards, the fashion, all the stores, the things they were trying to sell, the food had completely changed. Where before I used to go to restaurants that were specifically for hummus and falafel and some kind of roasted chicken, I found places called Checkers that were fast food hamburger joints or the donut shop. These things, you know, that's what surprised me the most, is how Palestinian autonomy became a tool for foreign corporations to invest. So it was incredibly disheartening. And I had to deal with that before starting at Hebrew University, which then flipped the coin again into a new reality.
So when you were growing up, what were you taught about Israel and Israelis?
I am a Palestinian, and I'm living in America because something called Israel made me go there. That was my understanding of it. That was when I was really, really young. When I got to maybe, I guess, junior high and high school, that became a lot more sophisticated, the understanding of what the Israeli state was and how it was declared in 1948 and what that meant to Palestinians. But I think the basic feeling that we had at home wasn't that, oh, here are these murderers. When you say Israel, when I was a kid, all I could tell you is that they were the enemy. That's what I knew. I knew that I wasn't in Palestine as we were speaking because of something called Israel. There was no such thing to me as Israelis. All I knew, that there was an entity called Israel that kicked me out.
So then how does a Palestinian-American girl, given that upbringing, end up studying at Hebrew University in Israel?
She ends up studying there without choice. As I was growing up, and I developed my own opinions of what was going on and more politically about history and what does it mean and what options we have for the future, I am the strongest advocate of coexistence. I believe that the only way to solve this problem is that if we all live together, but not in this love will unite us all. It has to be a coexistence that addresses the disparate power dynamics, one that addresses a history of expulsion and refugees, et cetera, et cetera. So in my effort to show that we can live together, I also wanted to learn the Hebrew. And I wanted to learn the Hebrew for several reasons. One was because I thought that it was very important, especially under military occupation, to know what was being said about you. Number two, because there were a lot of Israeli documents that I could probably refer to in the future that would tell me about the status of Palestine in 1948 and then in consequent years. The fact that I went to Hebrew University wasn't a conscious decision. I didn't look through my options and say, you know what, I'm going to go and challenge myself and put myself in a Zionist institution among people who don't want me there just to try it. I actually wanted to study in a Palestinian university to learn the reality of what being Palestinian under occupation meant. But through UC Berkeley, you don't have that option. When I asked them that we look into putting me in a Palestinian university for a study abroad program, they said, we're sorry, but we can't threaten your security like that. They were telling a Palestinian American that they can't threaten her security by putting her in a Palestinian university. And then in the next sentence to tell me, oh, but don't worry, you can study at either Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University, or Ben-Gurion in the Negev. So basically, I chose Hebrew U because of a lack of choices and because Hebrew U was in West Jerusalem and my village of Abu Dis is right on the outskirts of East Jerusalem. So it was only about a half an hour drive in the morning.
Why did UC Berkeley think it was safer for you to be in Israel than in Palestine?
It's a lot of racism. It's a lot of stereotypes. It's a lot of not addressing why there would be an uprising among Palestinians. You know, it's that whole issue. Are Palestinians freedom fighters or are they terrorists? And I absolutely disagree that they are terrorists. They're not. But for UC Berkeley, as an institution that's already in a place of power, and probably hypocritical because it doesn't recognize its own power, thinks that it would be safer for me to be in Israel, among Israelis. Not that that was the problem for me. The issue for me was more the racism involved that denied me access to a Palestinian university, because Palestinians are not inherently going to be violent with people that come by. The reason that there is violence among Palestinians and that it's generated is against occupational forces. It's something learned to resist occupation, but it's not used against people. So whether you're Israeli or Palestinian American or you're Jewish American, being at a Palestinian university is no threat to your security when you come as a neighbor and not as a conqueror.
Okay, how about how the teachers treated you? You took Hebrew. Did you take any other classes?
The only classes that I took was an intensive Hebrew class, which was 5 days a week from about 9 a.m. till 2. That was pretty much enough for 2 months. So I only had direct contact with 2 teachers, and it was really strange. One of the teachers, I think, felt sorry for me because she always used to ask, how does it make you feel to be in this class? Are you okay? And I guess she was apologetic in a sense. That didn't mean that she was on my side or anything. She just felt bad. The other teacher, on the other hand, just didn't like my presence. I think she was more intimidated by me because I wasn't soft in class. I wasn't quiet. I always made a point that I am Palestinian. I always made a point that a lot of words in the Hebrew language were from Arabic. A lot of the culture was Arab and Palestinian. And I mean, I didn't let things go. I don't think she appreciated that. And the other part of it was she always used to ask, why are you here? She was afraid. She was just afraid. I threatened the balance in that class. Not only that, but also the fact that I did really well in Hebrew. I don't think that tickled her either.
Well, you did grow up speaking Arabic. So tell me, what's Hebrew like? How does that feel as a language as opposed to Arabic?
First of all, they're both Semitic languages. So speaking-wise, Hebrew for me to learn was relatively easy. Writing and reading and grammatically, it was a little more difficult. But the difference is that when I speak Arabic, I feel it's more of a poetic language. I mean, although Hebrew is old, it was revived with the Zionist movement. And so it doesn't have a lot of poetry when you speak. It's not very soft at all. It's not very affectionate. Hebrew is a very aggressive language, I felt. I didn't mind it. In fact, when I was learning it, I was really lucky to be able to do this because other Palestinians can't, to separate the Hebrew from the what it politically represents. I was able to do that without any reservations, without any problems. The only part that I think the psychological did come in was when the Intifada broke out. Psychologically, I couldn't learn the language anymore. That was when I actually had a contradiction, and learning the language and being at that institution, and that was when I think I made myself forget it.
So the inherent aggressiveness that you find in the language, you couldn't use that as a way of expressing your anger at the situation?
Oh, no, no, I would. I definitely did express my anger and my frustration. Our first class assignment was write a dialogue between 2 friends, and you need to convince your friend to perform aliyah. And aliyah is literally, in English, it means to ascend. But what it means to the Jewish nation is that you immigrate to Israel. So I was writing the dialogue, and everybody's writing dialogue. What's great about Israel? Why you need to come? What you have to do? And my dialogue was basically 2 sentences. The first was, oh, you know, I live in Israel. Why don't you come? Why don't you perform aliyah? And the second sentence read, I would love to immigrate back to my home, but I can't because I'm Palestinian, and I don't have that right. And that was it. And I handed that paper in. So I would use the language to express myself. In another essay, we had to describe the interior of a beautiful home, just so we can use vocabulary to describe the home. And everybody's writing about famous people's home, the White House, their home, their dorm room. And I wrote a description of the Al-Atrash home in Hebron, which had been demolished 3 times and was in the process of being rebuilt. And it had an outdoor bathroom and only 1 roof over the kitchen, and the other rooms still needed roofs, and it still needed some sort of insulation because it was just cement on cement. And so I wrote that essay and turned it in. In class, I didn't necessarily lash out at the students. I didn't make it a point because I felt the students were part of the problem, but not because they were present in the Israeli state, but because they didn't know, because of the misinformation that they've been taught of the origin of the state of Israel, how it exists, and how they justify uprooting and the denial of existence and rights for their Palestinian neighbors, co-inhabitants. I never really lashed out at them in class. The only time I did, and I did it in English, well, before the Intifada anyway, was when one student was speaking to this Brazilian girl and saying, you know, Israel is just as dangerous as Brazil. It's just really dangerous. So I asked him, what's so dangerous about being here? And he just stopped. And so I asked him again, and he didn't answer. And so I pointed out to him, I said that a disarmed civilian population is nothing to be feared next to an aggressive, militant, literally military state, where settlers are in cities and they're not only allowed to have guns and ammunition, they're provided with it. And that each person is escorted by a soldier. And I told him the story of when I was in Hebron. It was August 9th, Tisha B'Av, the specific holiday about mourning the destruction of the two temples. And so that day, I went to Hebron, and the settlers had come from the settlement into the Palestinian markets and churned over the vegetables and were basically trying to pick a fight. And the soldiers came by and weren't stopping it really, but they were just there observing. And I was with two journalists, and we happened to be going by, and we see this, and the journalists are recording, and so I'm sort of standing by myself. And because of my Western dress, nobody really knew where to put me because there were two sides. Where the Palestinians stood, really just not trying to pick the fight, just watching what was going on, and where the Jewish settlers were getting more and more and more aggressive. And so I was just sort of standing in between on that line, watching what was going on, how the Israeli soldiers were going to react to this, what was going to happen, how far were the settlers going to go with this. And I speak in Arabic to one of the journalists, and two young boys, Jewish settlers, hear me say that, and they tell me to go home. And I don't respond to them. I just stand where I'm at. And when they see that I'm defiant, that I'm not afraid of them, they stood behind me and started to loogie on my back.
That's what?
Loogie is deep spit from the back of your throat, sort of like, and you spit that out. And they were spitting on me because I happened to speak in Arabic and they didn't want me there. And earlier that day, Jewish settler girls, young girls, I was walking. I didn't talk to them. I had nothing to do with them. And they were calling me bitch for just being there. I relayed that story to this particular guy in my class. And I was trying to get across to him that really the Jews that are coming have less to fear from a civilian population than do Palestinians.
Were you harassed by any of the students?
No, not once, not a single time. I was in the Rothberg International School, and so I was just among a lot of American Jews, Brazilian Jews, European Jews, a lot of Jewish students from abroad. So they've seen Palestinian Americans everywhere they've gone, and it's not as if I was confrontational with them that they needed to harass me. Though I think that the only thing I got wasn't necessarily that they made me feel like crap. They didn't spit on me. They didn't scream at me. They didn't curse me. None of that. But what they did do was deny who I was. It's almost as if to get along with me, they erased my identity. And the attitude I got from the Jewish students was, we're all willing to be your friends. Just don't make this an issue. You either accept it and we're friends. And if you don't, then we're going to have problems.
Did you feel any particular kind of treatment towards you because you're an American?
No, because it's amazing how many Americans are there, and then how many of those American Jewish students knew each other because of the Jewish-American camps that happen here in the States. It's like a transnational network across the United States, and so they all knew each other. The majority of it were, they were American.
So once the Intifada broke out, did you feel safe going to the school?
First of all, I think for the first 3 days, there was no movement. I lived in a small village and there was no movement. You couldn't drive your car outside of the border of the village. So for the first 3 days, I couldn't move. When I started to go, there was a stronger soldier presence, military presence, and they would just line up with their jeeps and turn us back, literally. I was pulled out of taxis several times and our taxi driver would have to go back and I'd have to wait for some other way to get to class. But it wasn't dangerous at all. It was aggravating. It was aggravating that at that point, I think already 13 Palestinians had been killed. And the first one was my neighbor, directly my neighbor, Bilal Ali Afane. And the fact that, you know, we've seen all of this and now we're being punished for that. All these murders that have happened, and now you're going to tell me where I can and cannot go? Shouldn't you be the one being punished? You are the murderer. You are the murderer. And so I think it was a lot of anger, so that when I used to get to campus, I would really kick myself for being there, because campus was just another world. Within a time frame of a half an hour, I went from a city of mourning, anger, and frustration to a place where nothing had changed. Hebrew University, I could have been in any American city and not seen a difference. The only effect that it had on the students was something they saw in the news or heard somewhere, or the fact that they couldn't go to the old city, Jerusalem, to buy their knickknacks. And that's what was frustrating, is I was forced to live the Intifada, and they had a choice of whether or not to live it if they wanted to. And that was really frustrating. So once I got to campus, that it made me sick, and a lot of times I couldn't go to class. And the time that I did go to class, I couldn't concentrate. I didn't want to hear the Hebrew, because the same words they were using were the same words that were played to us on television by Israeli generals and high officials who were telling us, Palestinians, if you don't want to get killed, then stop resisting the occupation. That's what they were telling us. And so that language connection to me at that point broke. And I never felt unsafe, but I did boil over at one point. It was the entire class, a group of 30 students and I, going at it. And every kind of racist justification for murder that can be made was made. I think that was the only hostile situation that I was in. People that were telling me, if you really care about your lives, you'll just take care of your children, put them indoors. If you really wanted to make peace, you wouldn't be waging this war. And nobody ever recognized that they can't tell people being killed systematically how to defend their lives. And yet these foreign students were trying to tell me, you know, we know you're dying and we know that you're being killed, but you can't fight for your life like that. You have to fight for your life in a way that's going to protect our own.
Would you say then in the teaching of the Hebrew language, there was a lot of political propagandizing in the class?
An amazing amount. Ben-Gurion is just this glamorized figure. Nothing of his quotes of how he said to eradicate the Palestinians, or how when he came into villages and he saw the Arabs, he's like, why are the Arabs still here? The order was to expel them. None of that, racism, none of that bigotry was present. Of course, he was just glamorized. The reader that I have is filled with Zionist propaganda. And in fact, to sign up for classes, once classes were offered, all of them were just Zionist indoctrination. None of it was meat. All of it was a justification of the Israeli state and how to strengthen it. In fact, there were programs offered on how to go back to your college campus and recruit more people and to get more supporters of Israel. I mean, this is a really sick program. It's not that it's sick because it tries to build pride for your Jewish heritage. No. It was because they were really recruiting students from abroad to perpetuate this apartheid regime.
Do you think that at some point in the future you could perhaps study Hebrew again, maybe here in America, in a less politically inflamed environment?
Well, actually, before I went to Hebrew U, I studied Hebrew for a year at Berkeley, and it was just as politically inflamed. It was the same situation. There were American Jews in my class. I was the Palestinian. And it was the same situation where Nura will be your friend as long as you don't make any waves.
So at what point did you extricate yourself from this situation over there?
It was a month into the Intifada, and Hebrew U was out. We had a break from October 5th to October 29th. And during that time, the Intifada started on September 29th. During that time, I was going about and collecting stories for an oral history, interviews with the families of martyrs, interviews with those in the hospital, interviews with shop owners who had no income, fathers who had been laid off, with teachers and their education, with children who were just traumatized and wouldn't go out and play, with political prisoner organizations, a number of things. But because of that activity and because it required me to travel a lot in a situation where really travel was not safe and not acceptable, and for a Palestinian-American woman in Palestine without her immediate family, it was very, very controversial. And then also because of the military checkpoints that would close off cities, oftentimes I would have to sleep outside of my home, which is really a problem among Palestinian culture and society. To sleep outside of your home, you know, can suggest a lot of other things. And especially when people don't know where you are and phone lines weren't always clear. And so here in the States, my family, my parents didn't know where I was and can only think of the worst, that, oh, Nura's not home tonight, she's not sleeping in bed because she must have been killed. All the images on the screen were Nura blowing up. There was no distinction. And then in Palestine itself, my immediate family was just worried that they had no control over me, that if something happened to me, they would be responsible, that I didn't fear for my own life. And at Hebrew University itself, the administration offered me three choices. The first was that I would take a free ticket anywhere to Europe and basically flee. Of course, I wasn't going to do that. I wouldn't leave for my own personal safety and disregard our collective strength. And then the second was, you can come stay with one of the administrators in Israel. And that was ludicrous to me, to stay with an Israeli family to protect me while the Israeli military would kill those around me. That didn't make sense at all. And then the third option they gave me was to sign a waiver that said the university was no longer responsible for my safety. And I took option number three. But no sooner had I agreed to sign the waiver did my father call and said, I'm going to come to Palestine if you don't leave within the next 10 days. And so I was forced to leave.
What was it like to be locked down for 3 days when you said the city had been closed off as the Intifada started?
God, it wasn't even just 3 days. It wasn't even just 3 days. I wish that it was just those first 3 days. Every day was locked down. Life stopped. Cars stopped. Shops closed down. Schools were not in session. Television was just images of what was going on. People had nothing to do, nowhere to go. They just were there to wait for what was going to happen next. And it's the most unimaginable feeling. It's dead. No cars on the freeway. And you cannot go out. And I remember I was also in lockdown for 5 days, which felt like years, in Derdibwan, which is on the outskirts of Ramallah, with my aunt. And I was locked down there for 5 days, and my schedule really consisted of getting up at 7 in the morning, cleaning the house, having breakfast, cleaning the house again, watching TV, exercising, maybe cleaning the house. I might have dinner, and that was it. That was it. That was it. And the reason I kept cleaning the house, because there was nothing to do. There was nothing to do. I can go out and walk in the village, but that I couldn't do that till evening anyway. And that was just part of the exercising part. But you read, and you sat at home, and that was it. And for someone to have the power to tell me that I had no right opportunity to choose how I wanted to spend my day was incredibly draining. The frustration I had, I used to jump around a lot and scream a lot and cry a lot and want to punch walls in and write a lot and listen to the tapes that I had already recorded and try in any way to channel my energy.
You're 21 years old, you're about to graduate from college. What do you see ahead for yourself?
Well, definitely for the rest of my life, of course, with the Creator's blessing, I hope to dedicate my life to the Palestinian struggle. So what that means specifically, where I see myself going definitely into journalism in the future, and to make sure that the connection always exists between U.S. imperialism and hegemony, their connection to the State of Israel and the oppression of Palestinians, and as well as all indigenous nations, that these indigenous folks remain faceless and nameless in the name of accumulation of wealth. And I'd like to dedicate my life to letting the names be known of those that are told to us are nameless, and describing the faces of those that are described to us as faceless.
For Wings, I'm Kelly O'Romaris in Berkeley, California.